Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Peter Jones. I'm the chairman for this session, which is titled Adequacy of the Social Welfare System in Providing Pre-Retirement Financial Security. Our presenter today is Jeff Humphreys. Jeff has been practicing as an actuary in the superannuation industry for over 20 years, advising trustees, employers, employee organisations and service providers. He has also been heavily involved in the group risk market, providing design and pricing advice to trustees, employers and life officers, both as an employed actuary and since 1996 as a consulting actuary. Jeff is also a member of the Superannuation Complaints Tribunal. Jeff, over to you.
Well, thank you for turning up to this one today. Thank you for your time. Adequacy of the social welfare system in providing pre-retirement financial security. And we're talking there particularly about death and disability benefits, not the unemployment benefit. Although the unemployment benefit is a bit related to it. This bit of research comes out of something we've been doing with Industry Funds Forum, which is a body that looks at issues for industry funds. Not so much a lobby group as a, if you like, what can they do together as a group to improve themselves. And the bigger picture for that research is to look at the gaps and inefficiencies in the way death and disability benefits in Australia are delivered to people. And this is just really the first part of this. And perhaps the more interesting thing for actuaries is the methodology behind what is an adequate benefit. And something about social security system for death and disability, which is incredibly complex. But really, the interesting part I find of this is the philosophy of what is adequacy when it comes to death and disability. The research is done with the help of IFS Broking, who do a lot of work in this area as well. I don't quite know how we were selected to do the research, but in any event, we were. So the purpose is to look specifically separately for death and for disability because they're two different considerations. Define what we think is financial adequacy, pre-retirement, and test that against the social welfare system. Now, some of this research is still in a state of flux, you might say. And our while the Industry Funds Forum has seen the a similar presentation to this, the final presentation hasn't gone to them. And this is only a snapshot from the previous presentation to them with hopefully an actuarial flavour. How important is pre-retirement income? Well, we think actually pre-retirement income, you could argue, is more important than your post-retirement income. And that's for two reasons. One is that your post-retirement income really depends on your pre-retirement income and is heavily geared to your pre-retirement income and how much of that you're willing to put into saving for post-retirement income. So it's very important that it's not interrupted. And the second thing is that for a lot of people, in pre-retirement, you have financial dependents, and you may not have those same financial dependents, particularly children, in post-retirement. So protecting your pre-retirement income is actually quite essential, and that's what we argue. The next, just to put this in a bit of context, I've gone on and just set out some of the financial security pillars, and we call them pillars for death and disability because they're nearly independent of each other. Not quite, but the social welfare system, obviously, but then you could potentially have insurance through super, through your employer, through a union-based insurance, or you could actually have personal cover as well. And then there are compensation schemes in Australia for workers' compensation, compulsory third party, possibly public liability, sick leave, and of course there's personal savings is a form of security against these death and disability. So there's a lot of different pillars. And as I said, the broader picture of this research is to actually look at how they interact and where there are gaps and where, in fact, there are duplications and what we can do about those. It's if that part of the project proceeds, it'll be very interesting. The social security system, as you'd all be very aware, and we heard today, is an exceptionally complex system. It's exceptionally hard to understand, particularly if you just come into it, go to the websites or whatever, and try and understand it. So we actually employed an outside body that deals in the social security system day in, day out, a group of experts called the Welfare Rights Group. And they have an opinion, of course, working day in, day out, on how well the social security system helps in death or disability. No one could safely rely on the social security safety net as it currently exists, is their view. The level of income support are virtually at subsistence levels, and the legislation is subject to constant review and change, regardless of the politics of the particular parties. So that's their view. I think one of the reasons we went down this path to look at it as well, I mean, we could just sit back and say, oh, well, that's that, it's not good enough. But we thought we'd try and quantify it as actuaries, for one point. But there is a view amongst the superannuation industry that, in fact, Social Security provides enough benefit, that we shouldn't have to insure people for death and we shouldn't have to insure them for disability. So it's important, particularly for the industry funds who are setting these default benefits, to establish whether that's the case or not, rather than have this notion floating around. We need a definition for adequacy. The one we came up was the amount that ensures the long-term living standards of the person and their dependents are similar before and after the death or the disability of the person. And that's reasonably easy to state. We then, of course, got to start putting some numbers to it. But firstly, we saw four areas for that. The first one is we want to maintain living expenses. So not necessarily income, because part of your income goes to savings, but living expenses. So you can afford to maintain your lifestyle. We want to maintain the savings they're making for retirement, and we recognise that there are transition costs. For disability, there's also ongoing care. So if you're disabled, you're highly likely not to be able to clean your house or look after yourself as well as when you are able. We've come up with a different formula to that used typically by superannuation fund calculators and typically by the advice industry. I think I dug out two from the financial advice industry, and just very quickly we can compare them. So just on death, one of them I found was 5.25 times net salary plus debts is the amount of cover you should have for death. So there's something in there for your current income multiplied by a constant regardless of your age or gender, 5.25. And then you should insure all your debts without any reference back to your assets. For TPD, they just threw in an extra $25,000. Now, to be fair to them, for TPD, they also threw in 2-year income protection benefit. So I guess the financial advice industry is saying, well, here's the products we've got. How do we fit them to this sort of need? To be fair to them, that's what they're doing, whereas we're coming from a first principles basis. Another one divided net income, so income after tax, by 0.07. So instead of a factor of 5.25, that's a factor of about 15. Quite different. They added debts. They added medical expenses. They added education expenses, funeral costs. They subtracted assets, including your superannuation assets. But they didn't subtract your home. Two very, very different formulae, but I think the thing there is quite possibly they're over-insuring people. And that's just a reflection of the fact that the well, firstly, perhaps they've got a responsibility to make sure people are overinsured rather than underinsured, but also they're remunerated on the amount they sell. So you're always going to err on that side. So our formula has an emphasis on future expenditure needs, not specific expenditure items, and also on we don't have an emphasis on current liabilities. Because if you can look after your expenditure needs, then you can look after your liabilities that you've already accumulated. And one of the interesting things is, I mean, people have a focus on school fees and on family home, the interest payments on family homes. And when you look at the expenditure surveys of the Australian Bureau of Stats, 4% of expenditure is on school fees. So why would you take the present value of those and call that a major item you have to insure? Similarly with interest payments on the family home, it's only 7% for the average person. And in the context of setting defaults, they're a lot more important than that you cover all the other expenses as well, not just those two. Okay, so we take those four ongoing living expenses, savings for retirement, transition costs, ongoing care. We put some numbers to them for ongoing living expenses, and we do this separately for death and for disability. If you have no dependents, then you don't need death cover, unless for some reason you have enormous credit card debt. That's a problem for someone else in a way, because you have no dependents, so... if you have dependents, there's a factor times your household income. So one of the things you can get out of the ABS is household income. Now I'll go into some more detail on that. So we've used household income rather than personal income because households create incomes, not persons. If you think of a husband and wife, it's very hard to say who spends what on what and whose income is really at any point in time. Well, at a point in time, you know who's producing income, but over time... And what about the investment savings component of it? Household income also includes any income a family derives from Social Security or other sources. So it's all the income of the household. And we've applied a factor to that. We call it R1. It's a different factor for disability because if someone dies, there's one less mouth to feed, one less body to clothe. So there's an R2 factor there. I'll come to that too. Saving for retirement, we think it's very important to keep saving for retirement. No dependents, nil. With dependents, we threw in 9% of one. I mean, you can put in any number you want, really, but 9% seems to be reasonable in a context that disability was getting 12%. As it turns out, that's where the SG is going anyway. Transition costs for death, $10,000, and for... disability, $50,000. Not a lot of research on transition costs. For death, perhaps that's funeral costs. For disability, it can be anything. But we felt we had to come up with something. We're talking for disability particularly about the additional medical costs that are covered by the system. And we're talking about perhaps home or car modification. So just modifications to lifestyles. Ongoing care is not applicable for death, but for disability, we've assumed that the healthy couple, in a couple situation, the healthy person will look after the disabled person. But for a single, you'll need some care. You'll need someone to clean your house, potentially. You'll need someone to care for you, because we're talking about the severely disabled. So we allowed $50,000 for that, which in fact could be conservative in some cases, but that's our first cut. Of course, all these assumptions can be varied. So this R% I had in here, a percentage of the household income, gets us back to the expenditure level of that household. Expenditure levels, as you would expect, are not proportional to income. The higher the income, the lower you spend as a proportion of your income. So we have a factor R percent, and what we do is it turns the household income into what's needed to maintain household expenditure. What income is needed after tax to maintain your expenditure? And that R percent varies by the household type. There are six household types, according to the Australian Bureau of Stats. There are lone persons, meaning singles. There are couples without children and couples with children. There are singles with children. There are multiple family households, and there's other. And we've concentrated on three. We've concentrated on the singles and the couples and the without children and the couples with children. And in there you get about 80 to 90% of households in Australia. And the other thing you can do is break those households into income quintiles. So quintile being a 20%. And we can do that by household type. So for each of those three household types we identified, we can break the income of those households up. And R percent, as I said before, it varies by death and it varies by disability. For the obvious reason that there's one less person. Now, one thing you might be aware of, I wasn't aware of it before we started this, was that, in fact, most households actually spend all their income. So until you get to quintile 4 and quintile 5 in these household types, 100% of the income is being spent. So quintile 1, quintile 2, quintile 3. So first 60%. For singles, it goes right up to quintile 4. They're still spending 100% of their income if you're single, according to the Bureau of Stats. That's probably fairly important. Quintile 5, on the other hand, is only spending between 60 and 70%, no matter which household it was. So it's quite a drop there. Okay, the social security system. So that's the adequacy side, and then we have to look at the social security system. It's extremely complex. So there's more than 20 benefits, allowances and supplements, and subject to varying degrees of eligibility, income and assets test. And in fact, subject to varying effective marginal tax rates, because some of them are reduced at the rate of 40 cents for every dollar of income you might earn, some of them at 50 cents, some of them at 60 cents. And if you add that to even a low marginal tax rate, it's really draconian tax rates on these people. I've given some examples there of all the different benefits there are. And it's pretty safe to say pretty well every one of those has different rules around them. Let me take rent assistance, for example. You don't just get rent assistance. You only get rent assistance if your lease is above a certain amount per week. Otherwise, you get zero. There's a maximum to how much rent assistance you can get. So these people aren't people who can structure their affairs. You cannot know how much rent assistance you're going to get in advance, I would suspect. And then there are other tests on rent assistance. Disability support pension comes with a supplement. That's supposed to be provided to people on long-term disability, the sickness allowance and Newstart allowance, Newstart being the unemployment benefit, are provided to people on short-term disability. You get the sickness allowance if you have a job to go back to. You're disabled and you've got a job to go back to, you get sickness allowance. If you don't have a job to go back to, you have Newstart. The disability support pension, I don't know, who knows how much that's worth? Anyone? If you're single, it's $17,500 per annum. The sickness allowance is $11,900 per annum. The disability definition for the disability support pension, so for the more severely disabled person, you have to meet 20 points of disability, and it's all in the legislation or in the rules. But it's fairly complex what that means and how you get those points. You've got to be unable to work for at least the next 2 years at 15 hours or more per week, as in less than 15 hours or more per week. And you've got to be unable to attend any training within the next 2 years. So they're fairly, I'd say they're reasonably vague definitions compared to what we're used to, for example, in income protection cover. Now, some of the other ones that are interesting there, the carer's payment goes if the someone is caring for someone who's on the disability support pension, and the carer gets the same amount as the person on the disability support pension, plus a bit. There's a parenting payment if you're a single parent because of a death. There's family tax benefit A and B, which has no asset test, only has an income test, and that's quite high. There's a large family supplement of $10.80 per week if you have a large family, and there's youth allowance. And then there's a whole stack of these little benefits which don't add up to a terrible amount, but they've all got their own rules: pharmaceutical allowances, mobility allowances, telephone allowances. And you can probably see why we got welfare rights group to come in and help us make sure we've got a few of the numbers right. So the welfare system really, even if the benefits were adequate, there are some issues with it. If you don't know how much you're insured for, how much you're covered for, well, you don't have a very good product as such. And I don't think people would know how much the disability support pension provides, or the sickness allowance, or any of those fringe benefits. So you don't know how much you're insured for. It's not like I know my salary, I can multiply by 0.75. That's how much I'll get if I'm fully disabled. So there's a multitude of fringe benefits, there's benefit interactions, numerous means tests, varying rules on what income is, what is an asset, what are your net assets. The asset rule is a net asset rule, so it doesn't include your home or your super assets. But there's a liquidity rule. If you've got $5,000 in the bank, you have to wait while you spend your $5,000. You don't get any benefit for up to 3 months. Right. The other thing about the social welfare system is they only index benefits at the CPI, not at a WADI. And I'd argue that a WADI is a better indexation to keep people, keep the real value of their benefit in terms of where society is, rather than their spending power from a few years ago. Government makes changes frequently, so again, you can't know your benefit. There are enormous assessment and payment delays, and the return to work part of disability is very, very, very poor. And Ken Henry was in the paper, towards the start of this year, really, complaining that, yeah, there's too many people on disability support pension. There's up to 1 million people on it, I think, in Australia. And part of the reason, I think, for that is that people are very fearful to try and do some work because they'll go off the disability support pension. They'll have to go through the whole bureaucracy to get back onto it again. I think they see that as a real impediment to bothering to go to work. It's better off being disabled. So there's no real encouragement there that I can see. To be fair, we haven't gone into the rehabilitation side yet of this and what is there for people in terms of rehabilitation. But the actual design is quite poor. And I think also you've got the... you can earn some income from the pension, but it's not a lot without losing your pension. You can earn, if you're a single, you can earn another $3,700 on top of your $17,500. So about $21,000. It would all be tax-free pretty well, I would think. But nevertheless, that's all you can go out and earn. You've got to keep under the 15 hours per week. So there's not a lot of incentive there for people to try and get off this thing. And the government tends to use a stick rather than a carrot. all governments use a stick rather than a carrot. Okay. So when we did the modelling for the disability benefit, we compared the cash flows, the actual immediate cash flows, rather than the present value of the cash flows through to, say, 65 or something. And we just ignored the fact that, in our opinion, AUWAT is a better indexation measure than CPI. And what you find in the modelling is there are a lot of variables. So level of disability obviously dictates whether you're going to get a disability support pension or a sickness allowance. The age and number of children is very important, but how much you get from Social Security, whether you have a home or not, home ownership, your household type and your income quintile, post-disability income, your net assets are very important because, of course, net assets should be producing you some investment income, and that income counts towards your income tests and the level and source of care that you might have access to. So they're all variables that we had to pick up there. And you can imagine trying to collate these into some meaningful results for someone like Industry Funds Forum isn't terribly easy because I think we calculated there are 18,000 different scenarios we looked at, and you just have to cull a whole stack in the end. Modelling for death is a little bit perhaps more interesting from an actuarial point of view. We took the present value of the future cash flows from the social, well, from the post-disability, from the post-death point versus what we thought was an adequate present value. When we did the present value, we allowed for remarriage rates because a lot of people, once you remarry, you're expected then to be in a similar position to where you were when you had a spouse. Financially, anyway. That's our assumption, that you'd marry a similar level, marry into a similar level of income. And they're the remarriage rates of widowed people, which are very different to the remarriage rates of divorced people. We took into account mortality, we allowed the adequate benefit to increase at AUWATI, and we allowed the Social Security benefit to increase at CPI. And that produces a lot of variation over time, the that present value calculation. The annuity factor isn't a constant, as we'd all know, regardless of the fact that the financial advice industry thinks that it is a constant. And just on our assumptions, we're getting a number around 16 for females at age 40 as a maximum. And the remarriage rates are enormously variable by sex and by age, as you can imagine. And they're a lot lower. They're a lot lower. The highest rate, I think, from memory, was about 6% for might have been for males. Males tend to remarry more than females in a widowed situation. No, that was an individual age. It was the best was yeah, and it goes right down to one, you know, less than 1% at older ages. So particularly the widowed. Females in the older ages were remarrying from the stats we've got. And again, if you think of why have we used the remarriage rates, well, in the context of setting a default, we're looking for an average, really. What's a good average? Now, some people will remarry, some people won't. The other way of looking at it is to say, well, we're going to set it for the people who won't remarry, and then we'll over-insure a whole stack of people. So, I mean, this is really... this research won't actually set the numbers for anybody. It'll set a methodology, perhaps, if the industry funds like it. Okay, the variables were fairly similar. Age and gender of the survivor, in this case, age and number of children, home ownership, household type and income, post-death income, net assets. One thing, if you don't have children, there won't be any benefit really out of the Social Security system. That there's a bereavement benefit worth about $8,000, I think. And that's it. So it's only if you've got children that you'll get a benefit out of the Social Security system on the death of your spouse. How am I going for time? Am I? Oh. here's a little diagram to make it more complex than it is. For this is the modelling for the single disability. We're saying without children now. When we did this, we thought we might do it for the with children people. But there weren't enough households to make that really worthwhile. So I might just walk over here. We're really saying, what's your post-disability income? What's it made up of? What do we think is adequate? What goes into adequate is really what you used to have, plus a few extras, if you like. That makes sense. And then if you want to go to the next step, we take a ratio. But the most interesting parts are just that's too real. What's the post-disability income? The sources of post-disability income, of course, social security. Maybe they're listening to ours too. Will we pull a plug? Okay. So your post-disability, as I say, income's made up of social security. It's made up of your any income, personal income you might generate, and any investment income you have. The adequate income is made up of your pre-disability income. Just pull a plug. Yeah, why not? We'll just turn the power off. Actuary at work. Yeah. Can you still hear me? No. Okay, I'll just speak normally. Okay. So I think we pulled a plug somewhere.
I just switched the power off on the speaker.
Yep. Beautiful. Comparisons. The results are preliminary and we're still refining them, but I thought it would be interesting in this forum to at least let actuaries know how we're thinking and get any feedback on that. There are five quintiles. Now, the first quintile is really people that don't become members of industry funds or super funds as a general rule. The reason for that is their primary source of income is Social Security already. So they're probably households who are dependent on disability support pension or whatever benefits. It's also a group that contains a lot of small business, we think, who are taking low income levels because they're either setting their business up or their business isn't making a lot of money. But there is definitely in the stats, there's a lot of high asset type people with very low incomes who are fitting into that group. And again, they probably aren't in industry funds they're certainly not in big corporates or anything like that. So that's the first thing, and although I do show the results for quintile one, but nevertheless, they're probably results that we can ignore. Net asset distribution, if you look at this, I guess it's not a surprise when you think about it, but quintile five really owns all the assets. There aren't a lot of assets sitting around other than in quintile five, net assets. So the social security, the social welfare cutoffs for assets. I'll just give you. Actually, on the slides, we can look at those. But you can actually have a reasonable amount of assets and still get the pension, assuming you can't get much in the way of income out of them. So we think the primary focus for this research will end up being quintiles 2, 3, and 4. They'll be the people who are particularly their employees, who will end up in super funds, particularly industry funds. This first graph is for someone who's totally disabled, they're single, no children. And what I've shown, that the very first bar, up the left-hand side, we've got the amount you get per fortnight. And this is your post-disablement income.
and the social security part is just the blue part. The investment income here that we're getting is at 4% on $307,000. The $307,000 is the maximum amount you can have as assets before the pension starts to fall away. So these pensions allow you some assets, some income, then they just fall off at some sort of marginal rate, typically 50% for these, until they get to zero. Quintile 1 and 2, 3, 4, I've shown what their income is, their mean income is per annum. So you've got a feel for, you know, what sort of household income they have. And just broken up how much they need by living expenses, saving for retirement, transitional costs, ongoing care.
Now, for this one, obviously, it's dominated by ongoing care. So, but the beauty of this graph is you can just take the ongoing care out, if you like, and you can still get a feel for how it stacks up, social security system versus the versus our definition of what we think is adequate. So adequate certainly varies by quintile. I think the clear indication is, particularly for 2, 3 and 4, but obviously for 5, is that the social security benefit will not provide you with enough. And by a whole stack. And that in fact you'd probably say you'd be better off to be insured and lose it all because of the insurance than to get just the social security benefit. Now, to have net assets of $307,000 in Australia, if you're single, you have to be in quintile 5 on average. The other quintiles have very little in the way of net assets. So as I said, net assets are all your assets, less all your liabilities, but excluding super and excluding the family home. So to have $307,000 spare is an unusual, if you like, spare in excess is unusual.
Jeff, could I just ask how the mean income relates to the income, what the total income, or is that
total income? That's just to let you know, for quintile 1, that the mean income of people in quintile 1 is $11,000 per annum. So that doesn't relate directly, except that when you apply that R% factor, you get back to the amount of income they need for their expenditure. So for quintile 1, 2, 3 and 4 here, in fact, the amount they need is the income they're already getting because they spend all their money. It's only quintile 5 where you can see it's dropped down. Well, it's fairly close to 4. But in fact, the income level for quintile 5 is $114,000. The mean income for quintile 5 is $114,000.
Significantly more than the mean income for quintile 4. But the amount they need for their expenditure is only a very small additional part.
There's something in there for saving for retirement, as I said. There's something in there for transition cost. Any other questions on that graph? Because typically I go through graphs too quickly because I'm familiar with them. So all the 5 on the right,
effectively comparison with what you get. If you were relying on it, the 5 on the right being what we think on our definition is adequate.
So I've done the same thing for couples. Couples earn a lot more than singles, of course. In this case, if you remember, we've got a big ongoing care factor in here. It's $50,000 per annum, so it really swamps it at the lower quintiles. But in this case, we're saying the ongoing care is going to be by the healthy spouse. That's the assumption on these graphs. So we don't have a big ongoing care cost. What Social Security does is they actually pay the carer some money. So that's reflected in the higher
blue bar here. There's also a higher income, higher assets limit there.
Well, the other thing I should say, these assets are for people without a home, which are a lot higher than people with a home. Although the logic of that sometimes escapes me. And it's probably clearer here that even in quintile one, that there really isn't going to be enough through Social Security. But certainly by the time you're getting to 2, 3 and 4, Social Security benefit is just not designed as a way of ensuring your living standards will be maintained. And you'll see there the household income's gone up a lot, as we'd expect. It's up around $206,000 for quintile 5 per annum. A lot more than singles. And then if you have children, people with children earn more money again. They also spend more money. Well, the other thing I should say is these... we cut out all the households whose primary household person, because you have to have a primary person in there, is over age 60. So we've excluded all the age pensioners out of this. Well, that was the hope. So these are really, if you like, the workforce numbers. But again, it gets worse if you've got children. You're certainly not covered to any great extent by the Social Security system. We didn't make a value judgment on their lifestyle.
But it's
that's right. It's because if you're earning $221,000 per annum, you can have Chardonnay. Yeah. So we. It's to maintain that. Yeah. And. Yes.
So your expenses might, your basic expenses might be
completely. Yes. It's very hard to quantify which bits of, because you can get really good data out of the ABS, phenomenally good data. They do surveys on expenditure, and really detailed, down to the minutest things that you can think of, like dog food and cat food and stuff like that. But we haven't taken away the family pet. We haven't taken away the family home in any of this. We haven't assumed anyone should downgrade their lifestyle, because that's probably not our place at this stage anyway. So we've started with... And we also haven't said you should have enough to continue saving at your merry rate as a quintile 5 person. We've said, no, at least you should just go back to maintaining your expenditure levels. Well... Because the main reason is, to, at least to kick off the first lot of research, is because the combinations that are created by saying one partner's working, one partner's not, and what are they on, various combinations of what the other partner could be on, and then trying to work out at what point is it better to stop working and be a carer, it just got too complex for us. And clearly in quintile 5, if that's a single income creating all that, you're not going to stop working, perhaps. Or perhaps you are. Depends how much you love your spouse, doesn't it? Oh. Well, I'm just about done, actually, so that's very good. What else was I going to say about that? I think that was... Now, one thing trustees of industry funds... can do is they can actually estimate their the income range of their members now, because the SG numbers are getting a lot better. They tend to separate out the super guarantee contributions. So there's a proxy there for salary, albeit that some members obviously will be in more than one fund and have SG contributions going to other funds. But we did some work for one big industry fund where we got effectively a salary scale out of that. And after we got the salary scale, we ran it past the union, and they agreed that it was pretty well spot on. And that was really reassuring, that you could actually go into the industry fund and get reasonable data to approximate what the salary is by age. And in theory, we could have also got that salary by gender as well, but very few industry funds, well, none that I can think of, would separate out their core benefit by gender anymore. The core benefit is gender neutral. But correct me if I'm wrong. I just can't think of any at the moment. Okay, now the last slide I have is just on the death side. It's only the ratios. I haven't actually had time to put all these sort of nice graphs together on that. But the ratios, they're not particularly pretty. This is a male death. This is just the ratio of the social security income or the post-disablement income to the adequate income, as we've defined it. It assumes you don't earn any other income and you have no net assets. And we've done it for no children, one child, two child, three child. And really all it shows is if you've got no children, you'll get really no benefit. There's a little bit there, but not very much. And the other thing it shows is it's very dependent on the number of children. It's also actually dependent on the age of the children. These children are actually, I think from memory, are the 16 to 18-year-old group. But 18 plus is a different number. And I think 12 to 16 is different. Certainly up to 8 is very different. So a young family gets a lot more than an old family in some benefits, but in other benefits they get less. So it becomes very, very, very complex. So that's just an initial... It gives you a feel. Maybe it's around 20% adequate. Now, this is also not done at this stage on income quintiles. It's only done for the average. It's me done.
Thank you, Jeff. We've probably got time for just one question. We've only got a couple of minutes left.
Sorry.
So let me give you the microphone, and if you could talk into it, because it's being recorded.
Okay, thanks. Just a quick one. I just wanted to know, presumably a lot of these people on higher incomes also have death and TPD benefits through super. Did you ever think of taking those benefits out in terms of working out what's adequate?
No. We don't care where adequate comes from at this stage. We're only interested in what is adequate and what is Social Security going to do for you. So just ignore all those other pillars other than Social Security. So let's ignore the workers' comp. Let's ignore employer-based or union-based cover. Let's ignore compulsory third-party, sick leave, all those. Let's just see what happens when you compare Social Security to adequacy.
Jeff, thanks very much for your presentation this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, would you like to show your appreciation?